Before we begin, Simran and I would like to acknowledge that we're recording today's podcast on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We'd also like to acknowledge that we met and grew up together on the land of the Yugambeh people. And we'd like to acknowledge and pay respects to First Nations elders past and present.
Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Welcome back to Broadly Relevant.
I'm Simran Pasricha.
I'm Ryan Hamilton.
And this is the podcast for Burnt Out Divas.
Trying to stay
Broadly Relevant.
Hey, what's like a crazy thing that's happened to you this week?
This week? Ooh, I had a 1-year anniversary with my partner.
That's so exciting.
Partner drop.
And I also recall about a year ago, we asked the question on this podcast.
Yeah.
Can you get gay married at a Gurdwara?
Yeah.
So, and that feels relevant.
No. Broadly speaking. What about you?
I filmed a movie yesterday, which is crazy. It's my first time
so
ever
fun.
On a film set.
Yeah, I'm sitting in front of actor Ryan Hamilton.
I walked onto set and I thought I had one line, which I had memorized.
Yeah.
And then I realized very quickly I actually had to deliver 3 lines.
Broadly culture.
Do you want to start with your culture? Because I think it's less morose than mine.
Okay. Ooh, morose. What a grand name.
I love
word.
That word.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about Josh. Josh, his name is definitely Jack. Jack.
Totally.
Sorry. Jack Schlossberg. That's why I was like, yeah, is that how you pronounce his name?
From Teen Vogue.
Yes, from Teen Vogue. Yes. Yeah, yes. Also the nephew of JFK Jr.
I know him through Teen Vogue.
Yes. So he recently came out to double down on the fact that he's...
He came out.
No, I wish. He seems very straight, but I don't know that to be like 100% truth.
It's 2026.
You know, who is at this point? So he came out to say that he's doubling down on the fact that he hates Ryan Murphy's love story, the John F. Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette like story, basically. It's a biopic about their love story. And he's very upset about it. So it's like halfway through the season and it's fictionalizing the real life romance between this like it couple. And it's definitely copping some strays from the Kennedy family along the way. My colleague Tom DeSalvo just wrote that line and I was like, yeah, it is copping some strays. Yeah.
JFK is the one who got shot.
Yes.
I actually have a photo of him in my kitchen.
But this is his son. Okay, that is so random.
Wait, this movie is about JFK's son.
So JFK Jr.
Totally.
Yeah.
Because there's the JFKs and the RFKs and the...
Yeah.
And the MLKs and the...
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that all kind of comes into it. So Jack says, if you want someone who's never met anyone in my family and knows nothing about us, talk to Ryan Murphy. The guy knows nothing about what he's talking about and he's making a ton of money on a grotesque display of someone else's life. So he was just like really upset about like the whole situation. So if you don't know, JFK Jr. and Carolyn Bessette, they had this like very like tumultuous relationship in the 90s. There's lots of like paparazzi photos of them like fighting in the park and then like making up, and they just had this like very like hot and cold situation, and they died in a plane crash when JFK Jr. was flying the plane with him, her, and her sister.
Is there like a conspiracy there?
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
My conspiracy is that I think his foot was broken at the time and he didn't want to wait for like his instructor. So
you do need your feet to fly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, anyways, I don't know any like real history about that, but, randomly Carolyn Bessette, she worked for, Calvin Klein, and that's how they met through the Calvin Klein. Cause that's a person, not just a brand.
We forget that.
Yeah. We forget that.
Did you know Walt Disney also a person?
Yes. And a Zionist. Or no, Nazi.
No. Anti-unionist.
Oh. I feel like I really... Layers to that, layers
he was
to
like,
that.
He was like, because he made all the American propaganda films in like the war.
Oh, okay. Totally. Classic.
The thing that I find interesting about Jack's comments is because do you know the show Oh Mary by Cola Scola?
Why does that sound so familiar?
It's like been all over all the talk shows. So Cola Scola is like a cabaret artist.
Yes.
And I made this like parody of Mary Todd Lincoln, who's the wife of Abraham Lincoln. Mm. And it's this like... dramatized, almost like pantomime, like story of her life. And Cole has said in many interviews that they explicitly did not read a single history book and just kind of went off what they vaguely remembered from high school.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's such an interesting way to make art. And I think, yeah, sure, drag Ryan Murphy, but Ryan Murphy's not a documentarian.
True.
Ryan Murphy is one of the greatest artists of our time. You know what I mean? And so,
okay,
let him tell a story.
Okay, that's a stretch. Well, Jack Schlossberg says, this is not a documentary. That was one of his quotes. But yeah, I find the whole like biopic very interesting. I have always thought that it doesn't sit very well like ethically with me, like in general. Like it's not the first time he's run into controversy. Like Jeffrey Dahmer, he did that thing, and then the Menendez brothers. I wanted to read a little bit from this ZFeed article that was published when the Pam and Tommy biopic like show came out. It's about like Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee's like whirlwind romance, and Pamela Anderson basically like didn't want it to come out.
Did you know there's a house in St. Kilda and the entire front of the house is Pamela Anderson's face? Yeah.
I feel like she wouldn't like that.
No, it was like, I think it was sanctioned by her.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
Yeah, it was built in like the 2000s. Like
that is so random.
Giant. Let me show you a photo.
That's crazy.
So that's like the front of it. It's just,
oh wow,
it's Pamela's face.
Honestly, and that's love the garage. That. It looks beautiful.
Yeah. And so her mouth is like the garage. It's so weird, but I kind of love it.
Yeah, I also really like it, especially where it's like in St. Kilda. Like
it was constructed for and owned by a really bad AFL guy, though. So like,
oh, okay, then I don't like it.
It's a little problematic.
Ew. Okay.
Well, he is, but.
So, anyways, this ZFeed article, it's by Emma Rubin, and she writes, in a post Me Too world, consent should be something that is not only considered but accepted when given or declined. In the case of Pam and Tommy, it does feel unethical that the series was able to go ahead, considering it dramatizes and sexualizes an incredibly traumatic experience in her life and turns them into an avenue for entertainment and profit. She goes on to say, at the end of the day, you'll have to make your own decision about whether you think it's ethical to watch biopics where the subjects have been given consent. The movie and television industries are full of unethical decisions, and this is just one aspect. In situations where there is trauma and the real life subjects have not been paid, those who work on biopic films and shows financially benefit from someone else's pain and exploitation. While the intentions might be to portray subjects like Anderson in a positive way, it doesn't erase the potentially negative impacts that come from dragging these stories back into the spotlight. I found this interesting because obviously with the Kennedy one, they're dead. So like, do you still have to, rest in peace. don't know why I said it like that. They're dead. But like, do you still have to offer that same sort of, like offering to like the family of the deceased?
I mean, it's interesting because everyone's always like, people kind of expect you to walk on eggshells around people who are like recently deceased. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, you know, nobody cares about a biopic about Alexander the Great and you can do what you want with him.
Yeah.
And it's interesting about proximity to living memory.
Yeah.
That makes it like very, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. Very interesting. He does bring up the point that I guess because the Kennedys are still so closely tied to politics,
totally.
Obviously RFK Jr., he says that I think
him and that dead bear.
I think in the last few years, partly because of RFK Jr., but also partly because of Donald Trump, there's a lot of misinformation and iconography being used about the Kennedy family at a time when we really can't afford to confuse people. We really need to take a breath that we have to try to make things better. And then he like goes on to say, like, I think that Murphy should like donate some of the millions of dollars of profits to one of the Kennedy family's causes, which, yeah.
I think though... particularly like through the lens of celebrity and like celebrity at that scale of like being a Kennedy, you kind of, it's this devil's deal where like to be in the public eye like that, you have to give up some semblance of control over your own life
mm-hmm.
because you begin to mean different things to different people, you know? And like, that's the thing with like pop stars, you know, like Lorde means something to me, even though I don't know who she is, you know,
yeah.
But she means something to me.
Yeah.
And like when artists like tell the story of like the Kennedys, it's like, there's a reason they're telling this story now in this context. And it's not just like trying to be a documentary. It's trying to probably make comments on the way the world is now. And like, it's, I don't know. I question how much we owe truth to all the art that we make. But I think it's important that we contextualize that things aren't true though.
Yeah. That's fair. I don't know if in this like media illiterate world, like it's easy to do that, you know?
I want to push back on that because I think we should not make art for the lowest common denominator. I think we should make art that expects more of its audience so that we have the opportunity to rise to the challenge.
You really think Ryan Murphy's the guy to do that? Sorry, I've watched the first four episodes and I just wasn't getting that.
No, and I haven't seen it. But like, the thing is, I will defend Pose, which was a Ryan Murphy production.
Yeah, yeah.
And like,
Glee.
Glee was culture shaking.
Yes, you know? And stay tuned for that next week. Yeah.
So, like, Yeah, you know.
No, that's fair. Honestly, the thing that stood out the most for me is that everything seems to be a biopic or everything seems to be like, like there's no original ideas left.
Well, no, Hollywood doesn't want to work with IP, new IP.
Yeah, and it's so insane to me. But I guess isn't this like a new IP? No one's like made this story before.
No, but they're like real people.
Yeah, but they're
it's like the IP's there. But like it's in it like because probably what's happened is like Ryan Murphy was like, I want to tell a story like this. Mm-hmm. I probably can't get it like through with new people with like new ideas and new characters. I'll just use these people who's like have a story close enough to what I want to tell. And I'll go tell that story.
I think you're giving too much credit to Ryan Murphy. I think what he does is picks out like different.
God forbid I had a little optimistic.
To a white man. He picks out stories that get like rises out of people and doesn't really care about the ethics behind it. I think his track record.
Totally.
You know, it's like that's the thing. Like he exists within the context, you know,
of himself. All of which you came before.
Yes, exactly. Yes. He did not fall out of a coconut tree.
No, you're so right.
You know, but I do want adaptations to go back to like the way like they were kind of like adjacent adaptations. Like 10 Things I Hate About You is like based on William Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, you know?
Yeah.
And like Sydney White is Snow White, but it's like nobody knew that it was about Snow White, you know?
And, you know, like that Wuthering Heights movie is from Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, but like that's literally Wuthering Heights. And I don't want that. I want some creativity. I want a rom-com from the 2000s.
Like, isn't it quote Wuthering Heights? Like it's got quotation marks.
Yeah, that's true. She really thought she did something with that and then it flopped.
Yeah, I think if the adaptation was better, that would have been a really interesting way of framing it as something different.
Yeah. But, yeah. I really wanted all the theories to come through where she was like, it's a dream. And like, she's just like dreaming of like, and while she's like reading it, you know?
But the politics of adaptation I find just so endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
What do you have for me in pop culture?
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk about the Shia LaBeouf interview.
This is so insane. Around. This is like not – when you said this is what you wanted to discuss this week, that I was shocked.
Why?
I just thought this is so random of you.
Well, it came across my feed and I'm like, that is so interesting. And I kind of have like a little bit of a point to discuss on it. So basically Shia LaBeouf was on this interview where he was talking about things, but the key thing that was quite interesting was he made some comments about queer people and homophobia, where he basically owned up to being a homophobe. And I'll read the quotes in a bit. But what I might do is contextualize the actual crime that he is in court for
totally,
doing.
Because he didn't fall out of a coconut tree.
He exists in the context. But what I'm interested in this story, and we'll get to it after I give the context, is less so the what he did and whether or not he's a homophobe, because I don't care. And like, you know, like a lot of thousand blossoms bloom as far as I'm concerned in terms of homophobia. But I'm interested by... I don't know Channel 5 and who this media organization is who did the interview with him, but like the decision to make that interview with him and then post that interview when he looks quite unstable and indeed like going through this court case, he is not passing drug and alcohol tests. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something interesting about the decision to do that. I'm very exploitative about that. Mm-hmm. And also like I think points to the cynicism of contemporary media and the way that like it's all just like generate shock content at the expense of people's lives, sure. You know, because like let him be homophobic in peace.
Go on then.
Anywho, so
give me some context.
The context here is basically that the context of what Shia LaBeouf did, and also Shia LaBeouf, I was always like, my whole life, I was like, why is this man famous? He was just that guy in that one Indiana Jones movie. That was my introduction to him. And that's
who's in Indiana Jones?
And the Crystal Skull.
Oh, I know him from Hole.
And like he was in Hole?
Yeah.
I think I wasn't like...
He's like the main guy.
Oh. I remember watching Holes, but I didn't remember clocking who was in it.
Yeah.
So he was arrested recently on suspicion of misdemeanor battery in New Orleans from February 17th, which was during the festive Mardi Gras holiday, which is different to Mardi Gras in Sydney in that it's just a festival rather than a gay festival. Not to say that it's like not gay, but it's not like a gay festival.
Yeah.
It's not pride is what I'm saying. he was basically asked to leave at about 12:45 a.m., but allegedly punched two men and headbutted a third while calling them all anti-gay slurs, the F slur specifically. He was then released and has been going through the courts and been saying some things. On the interview, he said, amongst other things, "My behavior is bullshit. I got to deal with that." I don't know why I'm putting the voice on. But I will. My behavior is bullshit. I got to deal with that. Does that mean I got to go to rehab again? I'm just not into it, bro. I think that's...
totally king.
Ridiculous. He specifically said, "I don't think my answers are there. I don't. I really genuinely don't. If I genuinely did, I'd go. I don't think I have a different problem." He said he needed to deal with what he thought was a different problem. He thinks he has a small man complex. And that is such a rogue way of explaining away why you punched three queers at a bar.
Yeah, that also doesn't seem mutually exclusive, you know?
He then also went on to say, specifically in regards to what happened where he got arrested, was, quote unquote, "I'll be honest with you, big gay people are scary to me. I'm like standing by myself and three gay dudes are next to me touching my leg. I get scared. I'm sorry if that's homophobic. Then I'm that." And I'm just like, in the context of where you're currently going through a court case where people are like, "Did you do a homophobic crime?" Insane to go and be like, "I'm homophobic."
Yeah.
You know, to the media.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, girl, that'll be... I think the prosecutors will be bringing that one up.
No, totally.
But I'm shocked that he said yes to the interview. But I think that also points to like broadly his mental state. Because at one point he says like, "Oh fuck, I shouldn't have said that. Like my lawyer is going to get pissed at me." And I'm like, I think they will. Mm. But yeah, the media exploiting people. That's crazy. That's a problem.
No, it's a problem. I saw a different clip of the interview as well. And he was talking about, he was talking about his relationship to his ex-wife, Mia Goth.
Yeah.
Who, for one, I didn't realize that they were married, which was crazy. But the interviewer himself felt really, like, unprepared. Like, didn't know, you know, that, like what type of relationship him and Mia, like, had. Or that they, you know, shared, like, child. Or, like you know, or, like, knew that she had a child, but, like, how old that child was. You know, like, just, like, felt really unprepared to navigate this type of conversation. And I think that's like another adding to the fact that the purpose of it was to like get clicks and views. I think being in the media, it's like you're kind of always trying to
remain relevant.
Yeah. And like balance that, because I don't think this like type of exploitation is like of the new age either.
No,
you know,
no,
100%. Like when newscasters go like, and you know, someone's like flooded their homes or something like that, and they're like there and like filming things, you know, like that's also can be viewed as like exploitation as well.
Absolutely.
100%. You know? So I don't know like where.
I mean, what's the point of news?
Whoa. So true. Like information, I guess.
Yeah.
And stories.
But like what stories and what news? I mean,
this is the key question.
Of like news.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck the 24-hour news cycle, though, is all I'll say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Take me back to newspapers. I would have thrived with
so
newspapers.
So true. I wonder if I ever read a newspaper. Yeah. Yes, I have. The Gold Coast Bulletin.
I've never read one.
What?
Never.
It just can't be true.
I've held them in my life, and I've cut myself out of them before.
Yes.
When I've been in them.
Yeah.
But I've never read one.
I've never read one, like, from front to, like, back.
No.
No.
Like, I've read the front page or whatever, sure, but...
I take out section.
Interesting.
Like, my dad gives me the section that the comic book section, you know?
Maybe I'll try...
Try it out. Analog is in.
I'll read newspaper.
No, totally. I think this can be saved for like another conversation, but like the critique of the 24-hour news cycle is interesting because I don't think there's no place for it.
I mean, news does happen all the time, but I also think it's the expectation both like now we're having the conversation, but first there's the issue that like it forces news companies to find news to fill all the hours and sort of dramatize and repeat and sort of go deep in ways that perhaps aren't productive. And secondly, that it forces viewers into this state of like, oh my God, things are happening. I'm going to miss out constantly. And I think, I mean, to use like the current example, it's like, is there a material benefit to knowing instantly that the strikes happened in Iran the other day? You know, if I found out 5 hours later at the 6 p.m. bulletin, like, would that change much in the way I live my life? I don't know. Like, I don't think we need access to everything all the time, everywhere.
Maybe not you.
Sure.
Specifically. Like someone who's like in the crisis.
Totally.
You know?
But I also think then that's why we have like other communications channels. Like Australia's, this is another news story, but Australia's rolling out the test of the alarm thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, on July 27th
or something. Yeah, like we're all getting an alarm.
The Oz Alert something, yes. Where they can do like the disaster alerts on all our phones and make them beep, which is like slay. So over budget, but slay. and it's just interesting because, I don't know, news and information, what is that?
But like who controls that then? Yeah, you know what I mean? That? So I think like in that
Rupert
sense.
Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, you know, it's like that – means of like getting like the alerts on our phones that's still controlled like by the government, which you know could like is a bad thing, is a good thing. Then it's like news, who like controls that good thing and a bad thing? I feel like it's all good and bad. Moral of
there's
the story,
nuance to everything.
There's nuance to everything. Sometimes there shouldn't be. That's my hot take. It's not my hot take. I just was listening to a podcast today about it and I said, hey.
I feel like sometimes we don't need nuance.
Sometimes things are just bad and things are just good, you know?
Broadly News.
So this is like, we were just talking about like what is news. I was like searching through the news and I was like, what's interesting news? This isn't really news. Like nothing happened specifically, but I'm really interested by this tidbit. Basically, there was a report done by Monash University into the frequency of media suppression orders in Victorian courts. And turns out, Gag City, Victorian judicial officers hand down the most gag orders in the nation, and at one point were averaging more than one a day. Specifically, in 2023, Victorian courts issued 521 gag orders, which accounted for 47% of all suppression orders in Australia that year, more than South Australia, Queensland, Northern Territory, Western Australia, and the ACT combined. And I'm like, that's crazy. Even like New South Wales was like 200 or something, which is like, what? That's so much suppression. That's like bad.
So true.
And let me give you the context of what a suppression order is.
Okay.
Like that's like so important. But like,
no coconut trees today.
Basically, sometimes like when like a court thing is happening, it's like dangerous for the names of people who might be testifying or might be involved in the case to be reported on in the media because of like fears of reprisal or stuff against them. So for example, in like gang crime, there's a lot of suppression orders because you don't want like people, like witnesses getting killed and stuff. So like the media is not allowed to basically report on them. And if the media does, the media gets fined. And so that's why you'll sometimes like read.
It also fucks up like the trial process.
Yes, because you don't want to fuck with the jurors. And what you'll see sometimes as a result is like media companies be like a respected man in Melbourne from a respected family, and you're like, what the fuck does that mean? But it's because they're not allowed to name who it is, which you know is interesting. But basically, the key contention of this interesting report from the ABC or from this report from Monash, which the ABC was covering, is that it's used more frequently in Victoria in cases where there is like rich defendants wanting to remove the potential of like negative coverage in the media rather than cases where we need to protect defendants from reprisals and stuff. And I think that's a really interesting angle because, you know, money.
Period.
Anywho, that's all I have to share. I was like Gag City, you know?
Gag City indeed. That's very interesting.
Some more context, some more interesting context, because then I was just like reading through suppression orders.
Sure.
Did you know, for example, in the 2018 trials around the abuse of, from Cardinal George Pell, the Australian media was forbidden from reporting on the story until the orders were lifted, but international outlets based outside of Australia could do what they want because they're not based in Australia. So it was this like weird thing of like our local media actually can't cover what's happening locally, and but the international media can. And that's a really weird, that's like a weird energy.
I don't even know what to say to that.
You're a journalist. Yeah. you ever had a suppression order?
I've had to follow a suppression order.
How'd that go?
Good, because I just kept it suppressed.
Yeah, tea.
You like, know, that's crazy. I think it's a very important thing. I think that's like, yeah, as a journalist, I think it's an important thing to have. Yeah. If you want to talk about like, maybe giving the agency back to victims in terms of like making things public or private, so like Gisele Pelicot,
yeah,
like choosing to make her trial public, the fact that she like had the choice in that part of the system, I thought was like interesting and a very powerful thing. But sometimes, you know, like when the cases are more complicated and the victim also is like under a suppression order, then I think the ethics around that is like very interesting. Because like safety for that victim is like important.
Yes.
But I think in those moments, I think it's because I like know someone who's like gone through this and they were like under a suppression order and they kind of grappled with that. They felt like another piece of agency was taken away from them, you know, although it's seemingly to like protect them.
Yeah.
Which I think is more a commentary on how the court system supports you holistically, you know, like,
yeah,
and doesn't really explain to you why these things are happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's a conversation for a different day.
It's just like really messy.
Yeah.
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 But the whole article I found really interesting. So it was co-prepared by Miss Alicia McMillan, who's a veteran journalist who's worked for 9, 10, and 7 networks.
Who's just like, period.
Like really hammering home that like it's unfairly being issued just to people who have the means to like get these things. Mm-hmm. And so it's being focused on reputational damage. And I just find that is like, that's like so fascinating because like this is like a woke lefty take. I feel like people are always like, oh my God, like overseas, like at least Australia is really good at everything. And I'm just like, we're not good at everything. We have a problem.
Period.
That was my insight.
I like it.
What's your news?
Okay.
What else is happening in the world?
Oh, yeah. So I don't even know how to start this. But yes, Iran has just been hit by a massive joint attack from the US and Israel. On Saturday, they launched a coordinated airstrikes across Iran, hitting nuclear facilities, military headquarters, and leadership compounds. And ultimately, Donald Trump has said that they have killed Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, along with other senior officials. So Donald Trump jumped online and announced this death before on social media before Iran officially confirmed it. And I would say that these strikes didn't come out of nowhere, that's for sure. You know?
Well, I think there's a coconut tree we're looking at here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you want to go into the coconut tree? Do you want me to go into it?
What do they call them? The strikes?
Oh, epic fury.
No. There was there's a term that Israel uses for all their strikes, which is like pre. I forget the term. Okay, they call them preemptive strikes, which is crazy because a preemptive strike is just the first strike, and then you started it. You know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to share.
Well, yes, correct. Yes. Like the tensions between Israel and Iran, specifically, have been climbing for years.
Yeah.
Over Iran's nuclear program and its support for armed groups and things really blew up after a series of missile and drone exchanges in early 2024. And obviously Trump and Netanyahu were like bestie boo-boos, so they worked together on this campaign. Yeah, gone on this campaign, Donald Trump has said that the campaign will last for 4 weeks, maybe 5 weeks, maybe less. Those are his plans. I have been following this. I have been reporting on it this week, and I've been talking to a lot of people in the Iranian diaspora here in Australia. And what I'm getting is that the feeling is very mixed. There is a feeling of celebration that the Supreme Leader is dead, and there's a feeling of caution because it's Israel and America that have taken this charge. Australia has supported the campaign, and
well, we were one of the first countries to like come out in support of it.
Yeah, which was like really random. I felt like he just wanted to be the first person to say something rather than to form an opinion, you know?
And he's got to stay relevant somehow.
I guess so. but anyways.
Well, and then basically after like those strikes happened in Iran, Iran started firing back, but not just at Israel, also at countries in the Middle East with American military bases.
Yes, so that includes Bahrain, Kuwait, Dubai, UAE. Yeah, so a lot of different countries have been affected by this. And the EU is getting involved now. Like things are really, really escalating, and it's definitely involving more than just the initial three countries at this point. But I wanted to refer to TikToker Ariana Jasmine, who is Iranian. She's Iranian-American. And she says, I think there's two things happening. I think the Iranian diaspora is really celebrating this and truly taking that time to celebrate someone who's hurt them so immensely, which is the Supreme Leader. But she says reality is going to hit you soon if America keeps bombing Iran, because America does not give a fuck about civilians. They don't give a fuck about children. They don't care about women. And we've seen this with every American invasion. And I think she's trying to say that, like, whenever the Americans get involved in, like, you know, like an example is Iraq, when they come in and like do a campaign, ultimately it's not been at the larger benefit of these people, you know? And I think to, like, obviously we have no place to like tell Iranians how to feel. But from the people that I've interviewed this week, it seems they are confused on how to feel, to be honest. They are in a state of grief and celebration at the same time. And what a massive feeling to like undertake that, you know? So my moral of the story is, low-key there's World War III, but I think that we should be really reaching out to the Iranian diaspora in Australia right now and like having deeper support for them, you know?
I also just like, why are we doing colonialism?
Yeah.
That's my insightful
take. No, totally. But it's a complicated thing, right? Because I spoke to like one journalist and she was saying that like there was no other option. Like they didn't have the luxury of choosing a different option to get rid of the Supreme Leader, in her opinion, you know?
Well, and it's also crazy because like obviously in 1953, the Iranian coup d'etat. Are you across this?
No.
So like one of the last times that they had like free and open elections in Iran was, I believe, like pre-1953, when they elected Mohammad Mossadegh, who was then overthrown in a coup d'etat, which strengthened the rule of the Shah. And that was done by MI6 and the CIA. And it's just like, because like the second, like it's oil. The second someone like takes away oil production, because Britain obviously used to like have a lot of oil activity in Iran. And suddenly this guy is like, no, we're going to make the money, because as you should, suddenly everyone's like, no, we need to overthrow people. And it's just like, I don't know. I'm getting the sense that colonialism is bad. Actually, we shouldn't interfere in other countries.
White man like, discovers that colonialism is bad.
Like, let people have their own wealth and self-determination. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it's also like, yeah, he was probably a bad guy, this ruler.
Try again. Try again.
But because I think just creating a power vacuum isn't the solve to undoing autocracy.
No.
That's my nuanced take.
Yeah.
You know, and like what, like you can't just kill people to create freedom. That's not how it works. You also can't just bomb primary schools to make people free. That's not how it works.
Yeah. And that's the team.
I think I just like fuck empire. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Fuck it.
I'm nervous. I'm nervous to see what is to come.
Broadly recommended?
That's right. We have a new segment, babies.
It's 2026. We're trying something new.
Yes. So every month we are going to be telling our Broadly Divas just like things that we have been loving listening to and watching and reading. And Ryan's face is concerning me because it looks like maybe our podcast episode didn't record. What's happening?
No, because I'm happy with leaving this in the podcast, because I can actually see the recording desk thing, mm-hmm. I've been taking down the notes of when I need to do cuts.
Oh, that's fun.
So the editing is going to be so fast.
We're so on, and we'll get more into the tea of building a podcast in our Substack.
Absolutely.
That's our first recommendation. Go subscribe to our new Substack.
First edition already out.
Yes, it's already out by the time you're listening. Hearing this. Yes. Okay, Ryan, do you want to start?
Sure. With what? So, well, we've each got three recommendations for things we've read, seen, and heard.
Yeah, I said that.
Did you say that?
I said that already.
I wasn't listening because I was taking the notes.
Leave this all in here. Yeah.
Absolutely. Fuck my draft. Yeah. Okay, well, I can start with, do we want to like swap back and forth?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll start with a thing that I read. So I read a zine.
Oh.
I know. And I'm just obsessed with this zine. So it's from local music journalist Dom Blythe, mm-hmm. who has this zine called Show Pony and like covers like bands and gigs, and it comes out like whenever, you know, irregularly. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to be sent a copy of Dom's reviews of Melbourne Fringe 2025. Mm-hmm. So it's like full of like Dom documenting all the shows that they saw. But it's written in this like really stunning way where it's not like discrete reviews of like this show and then this show and then this show. It's like, this night I saw these shows and then I ran from here and missed the tram and saw these friends and had these thoughts. And I really appreciated the sort of way it told the story of an arts festival as not just like these separate shows that we witness, but like it all kind of blurs into one like messy week, 3 week extravaganza. Mm. And I just loved the writing on that. And I've also like never really engaged with zines. Mm. Like I think it's the first. Oh, it's like
it's a new frontier.
It's like the fourth zine I own. But yeah. I'm just like, it was a really solid, beautiful zine.
I love that. Yeah. I love that.
What was your reading?
Okay. I find it funny that I'm going to say this now, but it is a GQ article,
okay,
which is really random for me, but it was sent, it was recommended to me by my partner. The headline was, "I Was Addicted to Hair Transplant Consultations" by John Paul Brammer.
Right.
Great, right? I'll just read you the little tagline. "In college, I developed an extreme body dysmorphia around my hairline. It took countless transplant consultations and public confessions to come out the other side." And you can get hooked on damn near anything. God, drugs, sex, eating drywall. The human brain is a matchbook doused in gasoline just waiting for a spark. Some obsessions are more unusual than others, like the one I developed at 20 when I became addicted to complementary hair transplant consultations. I nursed this habit for 14 years. Only last summer did I see an opportunity to break it in the form of a hair transplant in Istanbul. Maybe that sounds like checking into Caesar's Palace to treat a gambling addiction, but allow me to elaborate. It is truly one of the most interesting pieces of journalism that I have ever read. It's Whoa. So interesting and so truthful objectively speaking, a pretty embarrassing, you know, like addiction to have, I would say. Like, you know, it would be considered shameful.
What isn't an embarrassing addiction to have?
Hey, addicted to love.
And also no shame to those going through it. Love you.
No, literally. But yeah, I have been really into like My Strange Addiction as well. I've been watching totally. A lot of that. Like the woman who is in a relationship with an AI chatbot. That has been really interesting to me.
I will say AI addiction, that is embarrassing.
Yes, that one. Embarrassing. That one, objectively speaking. But I don't feel embarrassed for this person like when I'm reading it. I feel like I am having like a little FaceTime with a friend, and it does some really good commentary on body dysmorphia and, you know, beauty expectations. And I think that's also interesting from like a male perspective, because that doesn't really get brought into the conversation a lot of the time. And yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I'll put that in the show notes.
Stunning. Should I go first with my listening?
Yeah, what have you been listening to?
So it's a new album, and the release of like, because it's been like a five, six-month-long release cycle, but I've been hooked. So it's an album called Star Scum City by a new Melbourne band duo called Two Charm. I've been listening to their lead single was called Boyfriend, and it was just the only thing I was listening to for about 6 months from like September last year. They call themselves the creators of a genre called Gooner Pop.
Okay.
And it's just like horny, gay pop.
Totally.
And I love it so much. Now, I was like, who are these people? Where did they come from? Who are they? Who are they?
Yeah, who are they?
I realized who they are. It's, you know, Cub Sport, the band?
Yeah.
It's literally Cub Sport. It's just a different project for them.
Oh, no way.
And I was like, Oh, and you know why I didn't recognize them? Because one of them got a haircut in all the promos. And I was like, I don't know who these two twinks are now.
That's so funny.
Which is so crazy. But it's literally just Cub Sport, but this time produced by amongst, there's like two producers on it. But also one of the producers is Nina Jirachi.
Oh.
Who we love because Nina is like just the hottest young producer on the Australian music scene. But it's just like really addictive, like fun indie electropop. And I'm just like, I'm hooked and so horny and gay.
Yeah, totally. My fun fact about Cud's Poet, that let me make this about myself really quickly. Totally. I once backed into one of them and spilled my drink on them.
Totally.
That's it. That's the whole story.
Great. Yeah.
Anyways, what I'm listening to, I'm going back to my like angsty YouTuber days. I have been listening to Dodie. Did you ever listen to Dodie? She's like a really angsty, like soft, like similar music to Leve. And I've been listening to her EP You a lot. She was like my, my breakup like songs, like breakup playlist. I've been listening to it, but it's really like beautiful and like very graceful and like you're tipping through a forest and telling a story to your friend who's like a, you know, a woodland nymph.
Unrelated to Birdie.
Unrelated okay. To Birdie. But yeah.
Similar energy to Birdie?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Real ones will know that L Mills, who is a YouTuber, had like a really big crush on Dodie. And that was a big part of my personality back in the day.
Dodie is bisexual.
Yes.
Dodie is diagnosed with depersonalization, derealization disorder, and said that sometimes it feels like I'm not real or dreaming, and it's caused me to have depression and all sorts of nasty things. I'm just reading the Wikipedia page.
Love Dodie. I hope she's not done anything cancelable because bring her back, you know?
And bring her back.
Yeah. So what have you been watching?
So I saw and I was invited to review this showcase, like a public performance of a new musical, which is getting which is now getting produced in Sydney in a month. So I got to see the like the before we start rehearsals, this is where the show's at, sort of version of the show. And it's called A Transgender Woman on the Internet Crying. And it was this like really fascinating musical, kind of like hyper poppy, which was so fun. Like, you know, like live audio, like live vocal, you know, distortion, following like a trans medicalist influencer and like a bunch of like woke trans non-binary people trying to bring her down. And then they fall in love and then they're like, wow. And everyone grows by the end.
Nice.
And very, very like internet-y and like full of like just the most, you know, like ContraPoints was mentioned. And I was just like, you don't see ContraPoints mentioned on stage. And I think.
What are ContraPoints?
ContraPoints is like a really famous leftist YouTuber.
Okay.
Who has been problematic, but I think broadly fulfills an important role in the leftist pipeline.
Totally.
And
oh, my phone died.
I thought it was really exciting because it was like theater about the internet, which wasn't cringe, and also theater about the internet, which felt like it was written by someone on the internet. Because a lot of the time it's like, you know, old people who are like, young people on their phones, it's so crazy. They're all influencers. And this I was like, oh, you get how it works. You get it, you know. You get the seedy underbelly of the internet. And it's kind of beautiful to see that seen on stage. Also just like more weird trans art, please. That was great.
Totally. I
what have you been watching, Simran?
I've been watching this family on TikTok called the Beaver Family. I hate going after you.
Tell me about the Beaver Family.
Okay, the Beaver Family are so cool, okay? So it's like it's a father and a mother and a daughter, like a grown daughter. And I used to see them like, you know, back in like a couple years ago. But recently the father and the mother are going through a separation and yes.
And they're TikToking it?
They're TikToking it.
Whoa.
Which I find really interesting because like from a viewer's perspective, they are like best friends. Like they're the perfect couple. Like they, you know, they sleep over at each other's places all the time. We're just like, what's going on? Like, why are they separating, you know? And then the mother has her own TikTok account and is kind of like giving like a different POV and is so gentle with the way that she's explaining to viewers that first, this is like not a parasocial relationship that you should engage in like that. But more so that she's like saying, you know, like although we're like best friends, like it doesn't mean that we have to be, you know, like lovers or like, you know, this, and you know, like they're like in their like must be in like their 60s or something like that.
That's
so
a healthy narrative about.
Yeah. You know, I thought it was really fun, like very interesting. And like, I feel very grateful that they're like so open with that experience and journey. Yeah. And you can see like how gracious they're being with themselves and like with the viewers. And I think that's really nice and kind and a great insight into the human experience.
I think what's so exciting about that is like there are ways for things to end that aren't painful.
Yeah.
And I think that's really beautiful.
Totally.
On a similar note, there's a theater company in South Australia who has been cut off from all government funding. Not all, but like a lot of government funding. And after a bunch of years of like struggling, they were just like, we're going to spend all our money, have one final good year,
put on
a fucking great show, and then end, and then end well with care. And I just think that's like, we need to talk about ending.
Yeah.
Because also, jumping another point, RBG.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Yeah.
What about her?
Isn't the whole drama like, she should have stepped down earlier, so like more progressive justices could have been put onto the Supreme Court.
Right.
And because she just like didn't end well, there wasn't that stewardship and care.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I just... we need to consider how things finish because nothing is forever, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, endings are just as important as the beginning.
Absolutely.
Even more important.
I don't think there can be endings without pain, but I think there are ways that you can invite that pain in a caring way.
Grief and loss and mourning, absolutely. But like, it doesn't have to be destructive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think endings can be generative.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, speaking of, this is the end of the podcast.
Shall we check out?
Let's. What's something you're glad has ended? I'm glad Glee ended. I thought it was like going on far too long, you know? I like, you know, the characters were getting well. I was like over the new cast, which next week, hopefully we'll be deep diving into. I'll sort it out. And also Ryan Murphy's my number one op apparently, so.
I'm really glad the construction in the CBD is mostly done for the Metro Tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think that specifically the walls around City Square being open, I'm glad that construction has ended because we have a new public space in the city.
Period.
A new place to film Vox Pops even.
Ah, wow. Bring them back, am I right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for listening. Yes, our first Substack ever will be out by the time you're listening to us. So you can find it at
broadlyrelevant.substack.com.
Yeah. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. If you like this episode, tell a friend, like us on Instagram. Love you. Bye.